thank you very much to all the panellists there. I mean, there's some really interesting remarks that come out of those talks we've heard about the sort of struggle and the labour about putting together a ceasefire and the work that needs to be done to get that in place. Eamon's made a very passionate plea for more attention paid to social and economic issues, and I think that's been echoed by other members on the panel. We've had Chris talk about, you know, reach out to allies. You might be surprised by some of the allies that have reached back to you. Questions about the unity and divisions perhaps within grassroots loyalism, and also questions about the representation of loyalism and the kind of story that perhaps is told about it. So with those kind of themes in mind, I throw it open to the floor. Anybody, any questions at all? We've one here, maybe William.
Yes, Stephen. This is a question for the whole panel, but primarily for Mr. Malley and yourself, because you're either in the media or study it. Mm-hmm. So it's 20 years on from the Loyalist ceasefire. It often seemed to me that when introduced by the mainstream media, politicians from other parties are properly titled Councillor Maskey, Councillor Rogers, yet when PEP representatives are introduced, they tend to be a former prisoner or loyalist, such and such. You know, their democratic mandate that they fought hard for is at best dropped in later on as a concession. Am I paranoid, or could the media really be this irresponsible?
I wouldn't apologise for that representation. I wouldn't apologise. I mean, Steve, you're elected, you should be respected, your mandate should be elected. So, I wouldn't give credence to that sort of behaviour, personally. But sometimes people don't help themselves. I have a website, evanmalley.com. And I have invited loyalists to write, and they have written on the website. John Howcroft, for example, he was a guest writer on my website many times. The next thing, he's arrested. For what? Now, I won't walk away from John Howcroft, but that's the challenge within loyalism. Gusty Spence, that wonderful statement which was so uplifting, everywhere, abject remorse for what loyalism had done to the community. What about those in that organisation to which Gusty belonged, who have dishonoured Gusty's name since those days through the application of violence to people within your own community? So there's an awful lot for us to learn here. But I wouldn't approve of denigrating the elected status of anybody, and I hope I don't. I hope for all elected people. I don't like playing the man or the woman in what I write. I like playing the issue. And Professor Brewer has drawn attention to the refusal to be party to this circus in the coming week. And the question is very valid: who is the clown?
I don't want to say too much because I've had plenty of time anyway, but I mean, you're not imagining that. You know, loyalism's image and reputation is dreadful, you know, and I think I've written some stuff about this and done some research into it, so it's true, you haven't imagined it. I think in some ways, you know, what I would sort of say to loyalists is if you're expecting the sort of middle class media, and there's predominantly middle class professionals in it, to suddenly change and give you a fair wind, it's not going to happen, you know. And the sort of the recovery of working class unionism's image and reputation in the media, and we talked about that earlier on, it's up to yous, you know, and it is just hard work, and it's going to take patience, you know, and you're going to be confronted from time to time with knockbacks and setbacks, and every time, all the hard work that, you know, sort of that people do, and all the good stuff that they do, it only takes one dickhead. You know, and that's what the media will pick up on, because that's the stereotype and that's the shorthand, you know, and there's no further explanation. So it is just hard work and patience, but it really is up to yourselves. And we talked about this earlier about social media. Mm-hmm. I mean, you've got and it was mentioned previously by another speaker, you've got a generation of young, articulate loyalists coming through from working class backgrounds. You know, it's not going to happen suddenly, but I think it will come. I think you will see the change in subsequent years. But it's going to take patience, you know, and it's going to take the application of hard work, and it's only going to come from loyalist communities themselves. Does anybody else in the panel want to make any sort of comment on that? Or can we
just very quickly, I always think just to be a little bit careful, not to see the media as some homogenous body.
Yeah.
There are various different aspects, and within newspapers, different political lines, different party support, and so on. And I think if there is difficulty with the media, there's nothing better than engaging with not sympathetic, but understanding voices within the media that are willing to say, well, look, this is the way you tell your narrative. This is the way you engage. Because everybody, at the end of the day, seems to blame the media because they don't seem to be getting their message across. On Facebook, I noticed recently that the Green Party were whinging because UKIP were getting too much publicity. And they missed the point that UKIP just won a seat in a by-election and nearly pipped Labour for another seat in a by-election. So that was the big news story. And when the Green Party does that, they will be the story of the day. So just always be careful and don't say, we're not succeeding because of the media. And maybe to look again at how you're saying things, to look again at how you're engaging, and just, you know, maybe a little bit of improvement can just get your story across a bit better.
Billy?
Yeah, no, I mean, I know and accept that, you know, loyalists have in the past. I suppose in many ways give a different portrayal of what loyalism is about. But I mean, I often wonder, and I go back to David Irving, Gary McMichael and David Adams, who I thought were very articulate voices, but still with all the media, you know, rallies around a bald-headed man with a muscle shirt on with tattoos and a dog with a T-shirt on. Now, why would anybody want to shift the focus from what was being said by the PUP and UDP at that time onto this person? So, I mean, my question about this isn't sort of, you know, about the media not giving people for a go, but why do you transfer this vision of loyalism to someone who's had nothing really to say? And that's my difficulty around this. So I'm just wondering why that happens. So that's more of a, I suppose, in many ways, saying that there's, you know, Machiavellian stuff going on in the background, because why would you move that? You would always talk to the articulate voice, but we tend to get these people who get highlighted all the time, and that they represent a voice when they had no voice, they weren't elected, and they certainly weren't articulate.
Okay. Brian, you were the next one with your hand up there.
My brother had a very phrase that he loved. He said that patriotism is the last resort of the scoundrel. There's very few scoundrels masquerading as loyalists in our areas. That having been said, one from Billy's point and Aaron's point, I think there's something more sinister afoot here. The British government came to an agreement with the Sinn Féin and the IRA and also the UDF and the other loyalists. They brokered a deal with them, and they kept their deal with Sinn Féin, and they reneged on their deal with the loyalists. Why do you say that? Well, we had a cosmetic exercise when the HET was brought in. After 6.5 years of operations here, they had made 72 arrests. Two were dissident Republicans, and listen, 70 were loyalists. It screamed of a deal having been done outside of the agreement. Where was the media? Silent. Where was middle class unionism? Silent. Not a word. But every time the media has deliberately, and I speak in general terms, has almost had a policy, and one wonders if they're not being motivated by the establishment, by the Dirty Tricks Department. Because surely if the Dirty Tricks Department has infiltrated the paramilitaries, they must have also infiltrated the media. And most people in the media, any time a PUP representative came on, only a couple of months ago, I was doing an interview on radio, and it took me 3 minutes to make a distinction between the PUP and the UDF before you could go on with the interview. It was almost policy as far as the media was concerned. And one wonders if that loyalism and unionism has been demonised deliberately over the past 10 years. Let me give you another example. 150,000 people hit the streets of Belfast in Northern Ireland to commemorate the signing of the Covenant. 150,000, 30,000 marchers and 120,000 people who watched them. Two incidents took place. A guy urinated over a disused gate on the Newtonards Road, was overgrown about 100 yards from the chapel. And another, a band went round and played the famine song, which was reprehensible, shouldn't have done it. But those two incidents were highlighted by the media. And what happened, 120,000, 150,000 people in the streets, virtually without incident, completely ignored. As there's something afoot here. The demonisation of one section of the community. Not only do they not have representation, but what their viewpoint is being misrepresented by a media, by the media. And that makes it extremely dangerous. And it makes it very frustrating for these people. Richard Haas made the comment that, look, if these things are not addressed, some of the cultural things, then there will be violence. That's what he said. And I fear that in the future, if this continues, then violence is a last resort of despair.
Thanks, Brad. Is it Dawn? Yeah.
I'd just like to address this question to Eamon. Eamon, you made some of the things I agree with you, but you made a remark about the issues that the PDP were getting themselves perhaps involved in, or maybe not the right issues, and if they were getting involved in things like education, inequality in Loyalist areas, etc., perhaps our nationalist neighbours would come out and support us. But taking your logic to its extreme, why did they not come out and support us for the sake of 5 to 10 minutes up the Crumlin Road?
I don't think that's a valid question, but you're entitled to ask it. My contention is the following. And you say, is my observation. The point I was making was civil rights issues. You argue, and you've traditionally argued since the whole flag row obtained, it's a cultural issue, that there's an attempt to undermine the culture of unionism. And I'm not getting into that. There's a validity attaching to that argument. But I am much more preoccupied. I live under the union flag. Doesn't cost me a jot. I don't emote over the fact that I'm living under the union flag. I'm not living under green, white, and orange flag. I'm not emoting about it. But I wear children. I am rearing children. I've got grandchildren. And I go into some of these Protestant areas. I know these people, young kids. No hope. No hope. Absolutely no hope. And that's my point. I think you have a great case within your communities for which to stand up in terms of the deficits in your community. My son went to Methodist College. I'm against grammar schools. My daughters went to Victoria. I'm against grammar schools. Historically, that's the way it evolved. But I'm basically against them because the allocation of resources to grammar schools prioritised at the expense of secondary schools. But I'm arguing collectively, I think you have a great case for promoting the deficits within your communities when it comes to opportunities for the young people in your communities, the infrastructure, the social structures. And many of these jobs coming into this part of the world will be located in Tigers Bay, in the Sandy Row, in Lower Shackle. None of them. And that's blatant. That's blatant discrimination against your communities. Those are big issues, and I think you would win support, global support for that. That's my only contention here.
Okay. Gentlemen there.
Thanks very much.
Russell, you made the point yourself very ably earlier on about that young fellow who asked you, what about me? I have no GCSEs.
Yeah.
You make the case.
I'm very honored to look at the humanization of some things. I think of myself as unconstitutional means, as far as you go. The day I got elected, It was a breakthrough to the PUP and Corian, and nobody gave me a chance. And I talked to Paul, so they gave me on BBC. It's the first thing he says, Russell Wilton, you may have life sentence prisoner. Talked to Paul Corian, I think it was Webster, Steve Webster, I can't remember who the guy was from. He said, what do you propose to tell your former associates in the UBR? That was the first question he asked me. He didn't say, well done, you did right, you know, that was a great breakthrough, you did this, you did that. The first thing I says, he says, well, what about your past? You're straight on in your past. I said, that's nice you asked me this. I says, do you ask to see him? Hey, Jerry Kelly, McGinnis, every time you interview them. I said, no, you don't. they laid on out the days on. So sometimes I've been attacked by, particularly by, I call the right wing the SDLP, the John Lats, this word, a couple long stories short, wrapped the green flag around me for us. I was attacked in 2005 because it was a minor post in the British Legion, and I was attacked a week before the election. He says, shouldn't he be on the ballot paper? How dare he be on the ballot paper? But what happened was it actually put people's backs up. But people told me then, town met me in the street. Because who's John Dahl to say you shouldn't be on the ballot paper? Because you're an ex-prisoner. What does he sit beside the storm? People like says who would make your pass in Bully Hutchins is PLS. Martin McGinnis, Jerry Kelly, former chief of staff of IRA, former director of operations. But he said that is never said, and it's never said in the media. And sometimes I think to myself, is it institutionalized? Is it dirty tricks or what is it? Because it should have been lessened and lessened and lessened, but it's still keeping on, even to this day. It's still on. Even 4 weeks ago, I got a message, and I knew where it came from. It came from the special branch, and the message was, tell your wee mate to keep his big gob shut, get his affairs in order, or we'll sell him a present. To be at a present for his son. I want to see an assistant chief possible. I've had no message to son straight enough, so they give themselves away anyway. Me and elected representative. There is dirty tricks going on. And people think otherwise they're living on the total green world. So we've got to get real here and see what is happening on the ground. And the reason I got the message is because I was telling the truth. As I always said before, and Billy always told me, tell the truth all the time, you never get caught out. And they didn't like me telling them to, particularly about the drug dealers, about what was happening in the area, and the fact that the half of them were employed as police informants by the police, so they didn't like it. But I had to keep saying the message, but they said, what I'm saying to you is, there is a feeling, a strong, strong feeling, among a lot of loyalism, that is the perception of what's happening on the ground. Thank you. Here we are.
Brian, down there in the front row.
Yeah, no, I just wonder what the panel thought of. When I joined the party 17, 18 years ago, one of the senior members of the party at the time said to me, you know, something in 10 years' time, we're going to be like Sinn Féin, or we're going to have this, that, and so many elected representatives and stuff. Now, it never transpired like that, obviously. I was just like, they just opened the hand of the panel. Why do you think that is? Why do you think that grassroots loyalists or grassroots unionists, whatever you want to call it, didn't come out and support the PUP debate? We had people like Billy and David Irvine, very articulate people, on the media, etc., getting the message across, but yet we didn't generate the votes. We didn't do what nationalist people did whenever some of them who may have refrained from voting for Sinn Féin when the troubles were on or when they were killing people, but seemed to flock to them afterwards. Why do you think loyalists, unionist people, why do you think it was different?
I think we can talk about the Brits, we can talk about the spooks. I think the real problem for loyalism lies in the Protestant middle class. It's been alluded to before. There's a demonization of the loyalist communities. I talked to a very, very senior churchman who I will not give you the position of because you will then know who he is, who described loyalists as people not like us. Now, that demonization, I believe, has turned into a negative self-stereotype. That's to say, we know you don't like us, but we don't care. I call it the Millwallization of loyalism. Like Millwall football fans who used to chant, we know you don't like us, but we don't care. Now, I think that self-categorization is also very negative. And I'll give you another example of what I mean by the way in which middle-class congregations commute from the suburbs back to inner-city churches and have completely no interest whatsoever in the structural problems, the structural weaknesses, the inequalities in which their church is based. They're just in and out. And I believe, and I've said this to Fitzroy, the solution to some of the problems we experience in working class loyalist areas actually lies in middle class unionism. It means giving up the grammar schools. We have grammar schools. We've abolished the 11 plus, but we've kept grammar schools. That, in my mind, that's even worse than having the 11 plus. Even worse. It's the worst of all worlds. And you've got middle class unionists and mainstream unionist parties protecting the interests of the Protestant middle class, keeping their grammar schools when the real issues, we can talk about culture wars, but the real issues I think working class loyalists face are educational disadvantage. It's long-term unemployment. It's social deprivation. It's high levels of antisocial behaviour. It's high levels of crime. Those are the real issues. I believe culture wars to be a side issue, a symptom of those deep structural problems. And the solution to those deep structural problems actually lies in mainstream unionist parties and the Protestant middle class. And they have showed no interest in solving those problems because they're quite happy to marginalise loyalism so that the Protestant middle class keeps on supporting mainstream unionist parties. So you've been abandoned by mainstream unionist parties. You, in the sense of the Protestant working class.
But 5 more minutes. Aaron wants to say something on that last point. So, Aaron, if you can be brief, yep, and then this gentleman over at the far side.
About 20 years ago, Steve Bruce, one of John's former colleagues, said that people wouldn't vote for parties aligned to paramilitaries. But I think that's been disproven this year, especially. And it's been disproven because at your disposal you have tools that no one had 20 years ago, which would include the use of social media. Old media is on its way out. You can topple governments with social media. You can get people elected who never had a chance. I mean, look at the Brazilian elections. You know, the lady who's an indigenous lady in Brazilian elections is being carried forward because of social media, you know. And that's just an amazing sort of change that's happening. And I think that you've got social media and you've got people who can use social media at your disposal. And, you know, you've got the tools now. In the past, it used to be very difficult to get work, to write work. I mean, I did it for free in terms of, you know, short pieces of work in the media. And if it wasn't for Malachy O'Doherty as the editor of Fortnite, I would never have published anything in Loyalism because he gave me a start in Fortnite. And Eamon has provided a platform, although I have to say I've gone slightly cold on that because of the abuse that comes with it and the attacks, not on the ball, but on the man that come with it. And unfortunately, that's what you've got to deal with. So it's not going to be easy. But I think that social media is a tool to be utilised here.
Okay, thanks very much, Aaron. One last from this.
You know, a point that people have said here is that somehow some of the outside observers are given the view that this party has morphed into some sort of radical flag protesters and nothing else, and somehow left behind what was the great thing of May before. And I've been around that time, and I suppose the question I want to ask is specifically for the party, what changed? Because the policies of this party, the work that people do in this party every day of the week, are the issues of facing educational underachievement, demand the rights of those who are in need. Looking at stuff about social justice for people of gay, different ethnic minorities, nothing has changed within this party. But the attitude to this party has certainly changed. And I would put it back to say, could somebody please explain what it was that PUP did that turned us from a breath of fresh air to the scum of the earth? Because nothing within this party and the things that this party do on a daily basis changed. And if that's the case, then either people aren't getting in close enough or being lazy to actually uncover the good work that is being done. And as I say, some things have been said there, but to me, I don't see it as an accident. There has been a campaign to lump the PUP with all wrongdoing. You know, Republicans were differentiated. They're good Republicans and they're dissidents. If you're a loyalist, you're all lumped in, no matter what, people are doing the wrong thing. So I would like you to explain what it is that we did differently to change that attitude, because as far as I'm concerned, we're doing the same things we did, and in fact we're doing it despite the rewards that everyone else got. As David Irwin says, people were hot like sweeties, and if you want to start hot like sweeties, you need to have enough to go around. There wasn't enough to go around for loyalists. You got a slap in the face, but people still maintain, still try to do the same work. But for some reason now we're trying to be explained or written out as just interested in flag protests. Just cultural identity is a very important thing to remember this party. But so are all the very things that you have said that we need to get back to. We're doing it every day. So either the media isn't looking at it or doesn't want to see it. And I'd be interested to know what your perspective on that is.
I'm going to say one thing. I don't think the PUP has changed. What's changed is loyalism.
Well, then you need to make a differentiation there, because that's what you said with republicanism. You made the bad guys dissidents, and you made the legitimate republicans good community workers and advocates. That's what you need to do with the PUP. I don't think it's going to.
Okay.
So why?
With that final comment, I mean, I've run out of time basically with 5 minutes. And I regret we've run out of time, because I think that's probably one of the most stimulating political discussions I've been privy to in a very long time. And I probably speak for everybody else, and relish the opportunity to carry this on and at another date, some other time. So if I can just ask you to congratulate the panelists on the guests and your time.